From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, it's the one-year anniversary of Michigan's right-to-work law.
It has not had a very big effect on the economy. It was sold as giving the economy a shot in the arm. I don't think that's happened.
Detroit's bankruptcy. What does it mean for public employee pensions in America?
I don't think that cities are going to start going bankruptcy like dominoes. And I don't think that this is going to lead to a new round of pension cuts.
Plus, two Michigan filmmakers take us to Medora, Indiana, where the high school basketball team symbolizes the town's struggle to survive.
There's hundreds, if not thousands, of towns across the country that are facing the same challenges that Medora is facing. We just wanted to ask that question, what is lost when towns like Medora disappear?
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Renewable resources such as wind and solar are on track to supply 10% of Michigan's electricity by 2015, as state law mandates. On today's program, we look at a recent report that says we could be doing more and boost that percentage to 30% by 2035. And then the losing streak of Medora, Indiana's high school basketball team compelled two Michigan filmmakers to move there and bring us a story of this small industrial town and the people who live there. But first, it was 1 year ago this day that the state legislature and Governor Rick Snyder passed a set of bills into law that made some very contentious history in our state. It was December 11th, 2012, when Michigan became the nation's 24th right-to-work state. The laws took effect in March, making it illegal to force workers to pay union dues as a condition of employment. So 1 year out, has right-to-work changed Michigan? We're joined for this discussion by Michigan State University economist Charlie Ballard and from the Michigan Chamber of Commerce, Wendy Block. Charlie, I'll start with you. 1 year out, has right-to-work done what its backers hoped for and its critics feared?
I think it's done really neither of those. It has not had a very big effect on the economy. It was sold as giving the economy a shot in the arm. I don't think that's happened. And that's largely because unions, for better or worse, were already greatly diminished in strength relative to what they were in the 60s and 70s. In 2012, only one out of every six Michigan workers was a member of a union, and only one out of every nine private sector workers. On the other hand, I don't think it's been as doomsday as some of the opponents of right to work said that it would be, because the evidence so far indicate that most of the unions have maintained the membership that they had, or maintained most of the membership that they had before.
Okay. And from your perspective, Wendy, what does the Michigan Chamber of Commerce feel?
Sure. So as you had mentioned, it still is very early in the implementation of Michigan's right to work law. While that law was implemented in December of 2012, it really took effect in March of 2013. In the midst of this debate last winter to make Michigan the 24th right-to-work state, labor unions and other opponents really predicted this doom and gloom scenario, declaring that the Mitten State had begun its race to the bottom. But really, despite these predictions, a funny thing happened, and Michigan's economy really began to turn a corner. Study after study shows that Michigan's economy is on the rise. Is it as large of a jump as some would like to see? No. But the Bureau of Labor Statistics shows that Michigan's civilian labor workforce and employment is growing, and nearly every industry in Michigan has experienced job growth over the last 12 months. And I would say that, you know, by and large, many businesses in Michigan and CEOs across the state declare Michigan's right to work as somewhat of a game changer for our state. And I think we'll only begin to see more of that as time progresses.
Well, I'd like the thoughts of both of you with the change in the business climate and the improvement. Can it be attributed to right to work, or is it the fact that America in general, the economy is pulling out of that tailspin that it was in?
From our standpoint, we do think it would be unfair to point to Michigan's right to work law as the only reason for Michigan's recent success. And, you know, I guess I would say that passage of this law is viewed as a game changer. It's opened doors to jobs and economic growth. But, you know, some of that also has to do with other things that have been done in the legislature, as well as things that are going on nationally. But certainly changes to our state's tax law, our labor laws, our regulatory policies, all of those sorts of things have also helped create a path to economic recovery for our state, which is a good thing for employers and employees.
What are your thoughts, Charlie?
I think Wendy's correct that it's early to tell exactly how far what the effects of some of these things will be. But I would say that we are just 3% of the U.S. economy. We have open borders with the rest of the world. And what that means is that an awful lot of what happens here in Michigan, like it or not, is really determined by policies that are set well beyond our borders and by economic trends that are really global in nature. We lost 860,000 jobs from the peak in 2000 to the trough in 2010. I don't think most of those were because of our state's tax policies. I think they were because we were heavily dependent on manufacturing sectors that had a lot of stress in that decade. And also, of course, the end of the decade came the what I hope is a once-in-a-lifetime financial crisis. There's nothing about Michigan policy, right to work or otherwise, that created that financial crisis. That was created in Wall Street and in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Then we finally turned around in the spring of 2010. We had 64,000 jobs gained in the rest of 2010, 97,000 in 2011, 37,000 in 2012, and 73,000 so far in 2013. I think it's possible to attribute at least some of that to policies that we've pursued. Most of it is a rebound that would have happened because of the recovery of the world economy and the American economy, regardless of what we did here.
You know, Wendy, I have to ask you, the Michigan Economic Development Corporation has been asked in a number of news stories about this anniversary. Can you give us the name of any project that came to Michigan because of Right to Work? And they weren't able to do that. And weren't we told by the governor and lawmakers as it passed that we're going to see the phone ringing?
Yeah, so I what I would say about that is that, you know, no single employer looks at one factor determining whether they're going to come to a state, but it's site selection experts across the country say that up to half of all companies that hire them to find good locations won't even consider states that don't provide workers protections like the Right to Work law. So Michigan was automatically losing out on these jobs and not even being considered for new opportunities. Between 1977 and 2010, Right to Work states enjoyed nearly double the growth of non-right to work states. So ultimately, we believe Michigan now has the opportunity to seize these job opportunities and to grow its economy. So, you know, while again, it's not a silver bullet, it certainly it does go a long ways to help.
Charlie, I'd like to get back to, you had touched on the fact that Michigan's unions had been losing members. In fact, I think your quote was Michigan has been a de facto right to work state for years.
Yes. I mean, we now have, with fewer than 16% of our workers being members of, fewer than 17% being members of a union, we are sort of like some of the right to work states were back in the 70s. We had 45% of our workers members of a union back in 1964. So it's been a fairly steady and long-term decline. You know, I want to follow up on something that Wendy said about the growth of the growth in income of the right to work states.
Mm-hmm.
What are the right to work states? They are the Confederate states, the states of the South is most of the right. That's about half the right to work states. Well, a big part of their growth has been that a generation or two generations ago, they were so far behind the rest of the country in terms of educational attainment. They have caught up somewhat. That, I think, far more than anything to do with their labor policies would explain why the incomes have grown more rapidly in the South than they have in many other parts of the country. And then as I look to the fact that even with that, the right-to-work states are still significantly poorer on average. Per capita income in the right-to-work states, more than $6,000 per year less than in the non-right-to-work. That doesn't mean that that's caused by the labor policies, but it does make you think there's something else that is the secret, and that something else is that the most prosperous states all have a more highly educated workforce. And if we really want to improve our state's financial and economic position, that's where we're going to have to focus. I don't think right to work is going to make a whole lot of difference one way or the other, but if we can improve the skills of our workforce, that will make a difference.
What will you be watching for when the UAW contracts with the Big Three are up in 2015, and you know, with the idea that right to work is in place now, and also keeping in mind UAW's talking about its first dues increase since 1967? Charlie, what do you think will happen?
Oh, hard to predict, but I would say, you know, even before the right to work and even before the auto bankruptcies, back in 2007 we had this negotiation. The UAW gave up a lot in that. They established the two-tier wage system.
Mm-hmm.
I think they understood the harsh realities in which they found themselves, and I think that will probably continue.
Has right to work, do you think, gotten union leaders on both on the, you know, the top leaders and at the local level? Are they being more proactive in reaching out to their members now with right to work in place?
I would say they have to. At this point, right to work really forces unions to be more attentive to their members' concerns and to basically tell them what they've done for them today. Because right to work ensures workplace fairness and equality, and it gives every employee the ability to decide for themselves, either by themselves or with their family, if joining or financially supporting the union is the right choice for them. So, you know, I think just like everything else in this world, people have to see a value in order to spend their hard-earned dollars to financially support something. So I think that's kind of some of the benefit here, is that making sure that people recognize when they're getting their money's worth.
And final word to you, Charlie.
Well, I think that's right. You know, unions, for better or worse, and I think it's worse if you're a union supporter and better if you're not, as I say, they've lost a lot of power over the last several generations. And that does, I think, force the union leadership to be very acutely aware of trying to convince their members of the value that they produce. Otherwise, that decline in union membership will likely continue.
That was Michigan State University economist Charlie Ballard. And from the Michigan Chamber of Commerce, Wendy Block. Thank you so much to both of you for talking with us on Stateside today.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you too.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It began with a New York Times feature story about a struggling boys' high school basketball team in a tiny town in southern Indiana. The story of the 0-22 Medora Hornets seeking just one win so gripped a pair of Ann Arbor filmmakers, they picked up and moved to struggling hardscrabble Medora for a full year to follow this team as it fought for that one win.
Do it again. No more missing layups. I'm sick of missed layups. This ain't 7th, 8th grade.
There was one year here, they averaged getting beat 40 points a game.
In doing so, Davey Rothbart and Andrew Cohn discovered layers and layers of compelling stories, and they've packed it all into a powerful documentary, Medora, which premiered at the South by Southwest Film Festival and is now being screened all around Michigan. Davey Rothbart and Andrew Cohn, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks so much. Hey, thanks for having us.
Davey, what was it about when you read the story of that long losing streak of the Medora Hornets that compelled you and Andrew to actually move there and undertake this documentary?
Yeah, you know, we went down there the next day and got to meet some of the coaches and the players and just walk around this tiny town, and it just had this eerie stillness. And, you know, we're from Ann Arbor, and you drive 20 minutes outside of Ann Arbor, you know, you see towns like Medora, Indiana. And we, just getting to meet some of the players, we sensed that there were some really important stories to be told, not just about their own individual struggles, but also about the plight of some of these small towns that were once, you know, places of glory and, you know, really great towns that had a great life, but also ones that now, you know, when the factories shut down, really become a place of struggle.
Andrew, give us a sense. How far had things fallen for Medora since the parents and the grandparents of those boys went to Medora High School?
Yeah, well, like Davey alluded to, you know, Medora, like a lot of small towns, you know, used to be a farming community, a nice farming community. Now if you go down to Medora, you know, it's a couple trailer parks. They're one of the few towns that still has their school, which is really important to the community, and we explore that in the film. But basically, it's just a mill. There's a bar there. There's a liquor store and a gas station, and that's pretty much it. At one point, I think there was about 2,500 people that lived there. It's dwindled to about 500 now. So, you know, people there, there's not a lot of opportunity. And so most of the people that live in the community, they work at the nearby town. So Davey and I, what we wanted to explore is, why do these people stay here? And it has to do with heritage. It has to do with a number of things. So those are some of the themes that we explored in the film.
Yeah, and do it very, very well. You know, it's interesting, as I realized, how Medora High School, and you show us in your film, Medora, very clearly how it's surrounded by larger consolidated schools. I mean, there were 72 students at Medora High School. And that's a conversation, as you know, that's happening here in Michigan, too, as we look at all the districts and schools that are struggling and should we consolidate. Talk to us a little more about how the survival of Medora High School and that identity symbolizes the survival of the town itself.
Yeah, well, Medora, this is Andrew. Medora, you know, there's, like you said, there's 72 kids in the whole school. Just to give you an idea, they have 12 kids in their graduating class. And this is a public high school. So for the towns like Medora, the school is really a huge sense of identity. And a lot of the kids that go to Medora, in fact, a couple of the kids that transferred into Medora that are featured in the film, they purposely transferred into the school because they wanted a smaller school. And I think that's really appealing to a lot of families and a lot of kids that don't want to go to a huge consolidated high school. You know, the individual attention that you get, the sense of community in Medora is, I think, appealing to a lot of people. And we wanted to talk about the value of that and what happens when towns like Medora start to fade off the map.
And when one of the townspeople that you talked to even said, if that school goes away, this town goes away. So it really does anchor the town, doesn't it?
Yeah, this is Davey. And you absolutely see that, because what happens is, you know, people start beginning to move away to some of the other neighboring towns, and once the factory's shut down and there's less jobs. And when the school goes, that's really all that's tying them to these towns. So when the school goes, it really becomes like a ghost town, and these towns disappear.
If you just joined us, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, talking with Ann Arbor filmmakers Davey Rothbart and Andrew Cohn. Their feature-length documentary, Medora, takes us to a tiny, struggling Indiana town where the tiny, struggling boys' high school basketball team is trying to get just one win after a long losing streak. And Davey, your cameras were there for some incredibly sensitive and intimate and often embarrassing moments. For instance, you're right there when one boy goes to pick up his mom after yet another rehab session. She's battling with alcoholism. And it absolutely amazed me that she didn't say, get that camera out of here.
You know, the people of Medora were incredibly generous and open with us. And we found that, you know, when you approach people with genuine kindness, curiosity, compassion, you know, people really are willing to open themselves to you and share their stories. You know, a lot of people don't often get asked for their opinions of the world and their ideas about things. And you know, when you're actually really genuinely interested, people are eager to have someone listen to them. And so the film is incredibly raw and personal and emotional at times. And really, it's the story of these four boys in particular, and you learn their individual struggles. Whether it's Rusty Rogers, who you mentioned, whose mom has battled substance abuse, and you know he's, you know, homeless. He's living in his car when we first met him and moved in with the player, one of his friends, one of his teammates' families, and you know, another player is trying to get into college, and no one in his family has graduated high school,
He battles a learning disability,
yeah,
doesn't
absolutely,
he?
Absolutely.
On top of that,
but what was amazing is the uplift and hopefulness that we were left with as we saw some of these boys transform and just really great things happen for them over the course of this year, kind of against all odds.
Mm-hmm.
These kids really are the ultimate underdogs, and their team, you know, their team's an underdog, but even with the challenges they face in their home life. So to see such triumphant things happen was really thrilling to us.
But there had to be, at those very, very early days of shooting, moments where you know, you have these kids looking at you like, who are you? How long did it take to crack the ice?
It was, you know, every player or coach was different. You know, there were some players who were instantly opening up to us. You know, Robbie Armstrong, who was a really boisterous kid. You know, he was just like, come on in, here's my life, I'll tell you whatever you want. You know, there were other kids who were hesitant, and rightfully so. You know, I think that that trust that you earn, you have to do it over time. It's not something that comes overnight. You know, I don't think you can just walk into a community and expect people to, all people to just open up to you. But like Davey said, you know, if you're genuine, I think once they get to know you, and I think it's about time too. You know, Davey and I, we moved down there and really became part of the community. And so we didn't, you know, go back. I live in New York. He lives in Los Angeles. We didn't go back on the weekends. It wasn't like we were popping in and out. We were a constant presence in their lives. In a way, we became friends. And so I think that's how you get that raw and those intimate moments, is by putting in the time and putting in the energy and really getting to know the kids, and so they trust you.
I want to play a clip from your film. We see a lot of a boy named Dylan, and Dylan has never met his father, even though his siblings had met their fathers. And at one point in your film, he has gotten his father's number, and he works up enough guts to make this phone call.
Hey, this is Dylan McSully. You might not know me, but I'm your son with Shannon Arnold. Well, it used to be Shannon McSully. And just would like to see you sometime and stuff. But I'll be in Orleans Friday. If you would, I'd like to come. I'm playing basketball with Medora High School.
Davey, how did you become especially close to Dylan during the year that you lived in Medora and made this film?
Yeah, you know, there were so many players to cover. Andrew and I kind of, amongst ourselves, along with some of our other crew members, Rachel Dengiz, Peter Likes, Mike Smith, all Michigan filmmakers went to Medora with us, friends of ours, and we kind of each assigned ourselves a couple of players. So mine were Dylan McSully and Rusty Rogers, and Dylan is just this great kid. He's, you know, he's very spiritual, a churchgoer. He was part of the church choir. Also, a really mischievous kid, and you know, had the hormonal instincts of any teenage boy.
Quite,
you know,
a ladies' man.
Girl crazy.
Yeah.
But we just, you know, we would hang out two or three times a week. We'd sit in his living room watching basketball games, talking about life, and we got so close. You know, and that relationship of a documentary filmmaker to the subject, it really expands beyond just being the guy with the camera and him just sitting there, you know, talking to me. We became close friends, and I, you know, tried to counsel him about things in his life, and honestly, he gave me counsel about things in my life. It became a true friendship.
Well, you know, it's interesting when one approaches. If I was in my TV reporter days, and I would go in with a crew and shoot a story, you are to maintain journalistic objectivity. You are not taking a side. You are there to be a conduit to tell their story. But in what you're doing as documentary filmmakers, you can get closer. You can get relationships and attachments, and that doesn't skew what you're making.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think so. I think, you know, we had great affection and respect for the people we spent time with in Medora, and I mean, we fell in love with these kids. Anyone that sees the movie, you know, we're doing these special screenings in Michigan, and some of the kids are actually going to be there from the film, and anyone that sees the movie is going to fall in love with these kids too. So, you know, it was impossible not to get close to them, and not just the kids, but their families. You know, Rusty's mom, we mentioned, who was going in, you know, coming in and out of alcohol rehab, but just such a strong woman who had been through so much herself. And you develop this profound respect for people who are gritty and are fighting through these significant challenges, but with heavy helpings of resolve.
But when you pack up and head to L.A. to start editing your film, does the relationship continue, or did that kind of hurt the kids? Did they understand what was going on?
I think it was strange, because we had grown so close to some of these kids that after, you know, when we were done filming, after being there for a year, we left. And the thing is, we're in the editing suite, we're watching this footage, so we're still spending as much or more time with them.
Yeah.
You know, watching footage, all the footage that we'd collected, 600 hours of footage. We're in there every day watching, still hanging out with these kids. But I think for them it was a little jarring that we just left and we're no longer such a regular presence in their life. We did continue to return to Medora, spend time with them, film more. And so I do think that, you know, that closeness remained and the transition worked out. But it is interesting when you get so close to somebody. What's great now is is being on the road. We're on the road right now with a couple of these kids, and getting to share, you know, after knowing their friends and family so intimately, it's a great joy for us to travel around the country with them, for them to get to know our friends and family. We can't wait to bring them to Michigan. For them to, you know, meet the people that we grew up with is just really special.
I'm speaking with filmmakers Davey Rothbart and Andrew Cohn about their powerful documentary, Medora, which premiered at the South by Southwest Film Festival and is now being screened all around Michigan, looking at a tiny town in southern Indiana and their boys' high school basketball team struggling to get just one win. And another person who really, really grabbed me in your film is the Hornets coach. Loss after loss, this guy hangs in there and he keeps working with these boys. And we'll take a listen here how he works with them, because he does not give up.
Proud of the way you guys worked all year in practice.
We've been hard on you. I've yelled at you. You know, we've been through tough times, but we've all stuck together. We've all been a family like we talked about.
And I don't know if you see it, but I sure do, is you guys have improved a ton. You have.
I know that losing streak's been hanging over your heads all year. We just need to play a little bit harder, a little bit smarter, and I think
we can do it. Show all this big crowd how hard you guys work, how much heart you have, and how good Medora's going to be.
Now, a lot of us watching might say, you know, Coach Gilbert has a demanding day job. We see what he does, and it would be so easy for him to go, you know what, I am done. What keeps Coach Gilbert there game after game?
You know, Coach Gilbert comes from a long line of coaches, and it was really interesting to watch him come into Medora. That was his first year coaching at Medora. So I think he was a little bit taken back by the losing, the culture of losing. It was really hard for him. But these coaches, to me, are some of the real heroes in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are guys that work during the day. They drive a long ways to get out to Medora. And for a lot of the kids, they are the only constant male presence in their life. And so when you see Coach Gilbert and you see him getting on them throughout the movie, it's because he cares. And, you know, I played high school sports. It's, you know, coaches yell, and they do it because they care, because they want the most out of you, you know. And to Coach Gilbert's credit, I've had a lot of people come up to me after the film and say, man, that coach, he is tough, you know, on those kids. But, you know, it would have been easy for him to go sit back and go, oh, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, we're gonna go 0-22 again. Well, I'll just put in whoever wants to play and not care. But you can see how invested he was. And I think that's what he's there to do. And I just, you know, with Coach Gilbert, I think all you can ask from a documentary subject is for them to be themselves. Yeah. And I think that's what he was. He was extremely candid. He didn't put it on for the cameras. And that's all you can ask. I just thought he and the other coaches are just great role models, and I think in a lot of ways, you know, heroes in this film.
You guys managed to pull in a couple of very big names as producers, actors Steve Buscemi and Stanley Tucci, both of whom are noted for the caliber of their work. How and why did they choose to become involved with Medora?
Sure. Well, Rachel Deng is our producer. She's a friend of ours who grew up in Ann Arbor with us. She's been working in New York. Helping to run Olive Productions, which is Steve Buscemi's and Stanley Tucci's production company. So from a very early stage, even when we were in Indiana, she'd be sharing footage with them, and they fell in love with the project, and the footage moved them and resonated with them. So they've been incredibly supportive throughout the project, you know, putting their names on it and just, you know, helping us spread word about the project. Last week we were in New York, and we had our big premiere. Steve Buscemi, it was a joy for him to find it. He was so excited to meet a couple of the players, Dylan and Rusty, who had come out to New York for those screenings. It was fascinating to see. He was the one, like, starstruck when he met Dylan and Rusty. And they presented him with a Medora jersey, and he just looked so proud to hold that up and have that.
You know, your film is really challenging in the way that it points out to anyone who watches that poverty is not confined to big cities like Detroit, which, of course, is grabbing so many headlines, but poverty is in small towns all across America. Do you see towns like Medora making it another 20, 30 years?
You know, yeah, absolutely. The rural poverty that we observed is so resonant with poverty I've seen in inner cities in the past. And the struggles, you know, many of the struggles that arise in a town like Medora are someone similar to what you see in Detroit and Washington, D.C., where I spent some time. You know, these towns are amazing. They really have, as someone says in the film, they have been the fiber of America. What the future holds for them, you know, we can't say. Medora, it really is, there's hundreds if not thousands of towns across the country that are facing the same challenges that Medora is facing. They're hardworking people. They believe in the value of community. If someone falls down, everyone else is there to pick them up. We just wanted to ask that question, what is lost when towns like Medora disappear?
Andrew Cohn, Davey Rothbart, co-directors of Medora. Fabulous, fabulous documentary, and it really was a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you, Sydney. Thank you.
And tomorrow in Ann Arbor, after a screening at the Michigan Theater, Davey Rothbart and Andrew Cohn will be joined by Dylan, one of the students in the film. They'll do a brief Q&A. We've put a link to the website and trailer for Medora on our website at michiganradio.org, and there you will also find a schedule of the screenings that'll be happening around the state. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As Detroit's bankruptcy troubles have become front-page news around the nation, so too has the thorny subject of public pensions. In approving Detroit's bankruptcy, federal judge Stephen Rhodes gave the city the go-ahead to slash its public pension and health care benefits. Municipal finance experts and retirement advisors around the nation are watching what happens in Detroit, and that includes my next guest. Alicia Monell is director of the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College, and she believes the idea that pensions for city retirees can be cut in bankruptcy is alarming. Alicia Monell joins us now from Boston. Welcome to Stateside.
Oh, happy to be here, Cindy.
Alicia, you were quoted as saying pensions are not the reason Detroit is in trouble, but I think a lot of us seem to have gotten that message from emergency manager Kevin Orr. Can you explain to us what you meant?
Yes, when you look at the cost of Detroit pensions compared to the cost of pensions for other cities, Detroit is just not high on the list. And the reasons are that the police and fire plan is really quite well funded, and the other plan is better funded than those in the national average. So they're pretty well provided for. So Detroit's under a lot of financial pressures. They do have unfunded pension commitments. It's just that in that particular dimension, Detroit is not particularly in trouble.
In fact, your center ranked American cities by just how much of a burden public pensions are. Where did Detroit fit in?
I think it was number 61. It was way down the list. 61 out of 173.
That, I think, would surprise so many of us who just have come away from, in these recent months, thinking that really it all, much of it came down to pension issues.
So, I mean, how much that of the promises that are not funded depends on precisely how you calculate what they call the unfunded liability. And you can make it bigger or smaller depending on what interest rate that you use. And probably Detroit uses too high an interest rate and underestimates the amount gap between promised benefits and assets. But still, it's not high on the list of Detroit's troubles.
We have certainly heard here in Southeast Michigan, and if anyone kind of close to Detroit has heard, that the eyes of the nation are upon Detroit and what is happening. And certainly we've seen other places where pensions of public workers seem to be under attack. We know Illinois legislature passed a pension reform bill that cuts retiree benefits. Do you expect other cities to do what Detroit has done?
I really don't think the Detroit situation and Illinois have very much in the way of implications for the rest of the nation. Not to be harsh to you, since this is your home,
sure.
But Detroit is a basket case, and the politicians in Illinois are just deadbeats and have not funded their pensions for decades. And so Illinois is always tying for last place in terms of the funded status of the plan. And so Illinois is the worst. And so you can't take the worst case in the nation and say, oh, that has implications for the whole rest of the country. And as you know, Detroit has, you know, just a host of problems, which makes it atypical. And so I don't think that cities are going to start going bankruptcy like dominoes. And I don't think that this is going to lead to a new round of pension cuts generally. I don't have complete knowledge of everything going on in Detroit, but my understanding is that there are two plans, and it sounds like the police and fire has been run in a rather businesslike way, but the other plan may not have. And my view is, like, to the extent there's any shenanigans, I have no problem with people losing money. To the extent that people are just receiving, you know, the benefit that you would expect them to get on the plan, from the plan, I hate to see those benefits cut.
I'm speaking with Alicia Monell, who is the director of the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College, as we kind of take a look at municipal pension cuts and what could be ahead, not only for City of Detroit employees and retirees, but municipal workers across the country. Should it be harder for workers to retire at a comparatively young age? I mean, we know that there are municipal workers who are hanging it up in their mid-50s.
Right. I think that's a very important point. I mean, I run a center that's focused on all areas of retirement, and one of our main arguments is that given how much longer we're living and how much healthier we are and how much more stamina we have and how less physically demanding the jobs are, that we all as a nation have to work longer. So pensions that are designed for people to retire in their 50s after 30 years or, you know, after 25 years in the case of police and fire, I view as not well-designed pensions. So if I were setting up a compensation schedule for workers in Detroit going forward, I would have something that looked very different. But I just want to follow on with that point, and that is that I don't want to lose sight in all this discussion about cutting, is that what we're trying to do here in Detroit, in Illinois, in every state and city in the union, is hire good people to run our cities and towns and states, to teach our children, to protect us against crime, and to help us in case of fire. And so we want to pay those people a compensation package, both pensions and wages, that is very close to what they could get if they went to the private sector. If you don't do that, then you're not going to get good people, right? Any young person is going to say, I can get more in the private sector, I'm going there.
Sure.
So I just think that this sort of hacking away kind of mentality is what you hear when you hear about both Detroit and Illinois needs to be reframed in terms of how should we structure our compensation package so we get good employees going forward.
Alicia, your work really centers on retirement, and I just wonder, from your perspective, how prepared are most American households to be able to retire, whether public or private?
Public is better than private, but for the nation as a whole, we put something out called the National Retirement Risk Index, which estimates the percent of households when they get to 65 who will not be able to maintain their standard of living. So, and that number is currently around 50%. So that says half of American working age households, when they get to retirement, are not going to be able to live in the same way after they stop working as they could before they did.
Alicia Monell, director of the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. It really has been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you very, very much.
Oh, delighted.
Just take a drive in Michigan's thumb, let's say, and look at all the wind turbines. And it's clear our state is working to get its energy needs met by wind and other renewable sources. Right now, state law mandates that electric providers must obtain 10% of their electricity sales from renewable resources and do it by 2015. We are on track to do that. But a recent report turned into Governor Snyder suggests we could boost that to 30% by 2035. And when compared to our neighbor states, Michigan's Renewable Portfolio Standard, our RPS, is not as robust as it could be. Joining us is the chairman of the State Public Service Commission, who led the renewable energy study at the governor's request, John Quackenbush. And we're joined by the director of the Michigan Environmental Council, James Clift. Welcome back to Stateside. John, I would like to start with you. What do you see as the biggest takeaways from that very heavy-duty report you turned in to the governor?
Well, yes, we took a look at the technical feasibility of doing more wind in Michigan and concluded we could do considerably more than what we have. We also looked at costs, and we were pleased that the costs of renewables have declined over the last several years.
What did your report find that was the most promising, most doable forms of renewable energy in terms of cost and reliability and results?
Well, we're focused a lot on costs, and, you know, onshore wind has proven to be the most cost-effective. We're able to do that currently in the range of $50 to $60 per megawatt hour. We've actually done one wind contract at $48, a little bit below that. And if we look at solar, you know, that's more expensive. Offshore wind is even more expensive. Biomass tends to be expensive. You know, solar costs are a great example of a technology where costs have come down considerably, but they're still quite a bit higher than onshore wind. And that's why our biggest focus through 2015 has been on onshore wind. It will be 94% of all the renewable energy that we've invested in by 2015.
So, James Clift, from where you sit with the Michigan Environmental Council, what are your thoughts as far as this reliance or this emphasis on wind as being most promising for Michigan's future energy needs?
I think if you look at what's happened in wind in Michigan, it's been one of the big success stories. You look at that price dropping from $110 a megawatt hour to, John mentioned, down to $50, $60 a megawatt hour, 50% reduction in 4 years, $2 billion almost of economic development in Michigan over a five-year period, really a success story. I agree with him in that I think wind will continue to dominate if we were to move our standard up a little bit here for at least the next maybe 5 years. But then I think you look at that price curve of solar coming down, I think it would then have some really significant penetration as we move forward with our RPS.
And I would have to think that you don't have the issues with solar that you might with wind in terms of siting, because not everybody wants wind farms, do they?
No, you have it. You can just have it on the top of a roof anywhere. And the other great advantage is the fact that, hey, it's usually generating electricity right when we need it in the middle of the time during our peak energy use hours.
That was James Clift speaking. He's the director of the Michigan Environmental Council. He's joined by John Quackenbush, who is the chairman of the State Public Service Commission, as we look at Michigan's renewable resources goals. Now, John, the report you did looks at Michigan's ability to meet a 10% renewable energy goal by 2015. But the report you helped put together for the governor says Michigan's renewable portfolio standard is one of the less aggressive programs when compared to others, based solely on the target number. Why is that?
Well, I'd like to just maybe alter that a little bit. You know, that is true when you look at the raw number and say 10% sounds like a really low number. But in Michigan, we haven't exempted anybody. There's other states that have a higher sounding goal. Let's say they say their goal is 15% by a certain year, but then maybe they exempt half of the utilities from participating. So in Michigan, we have every investor-owned utility, we have all the municipal utilities, and we have co-ops all participating. So it's 100% participation. It also applies to alternative electric suppliers, too. So it sounds low, but it actually, if we had the Union of Concerned Scientists take a look and submit some comments to us recently, that showed if you looked at Michigan's current support for renewable energy through 2015, we actually would rank 11th from the top, which is better than it would be if you just looked at the raw number of 10%.
So it's kind of an apples to oranges thing based on just looking at the raw numbers, at the target
yes.
numbers. Now, we hear that these headlines that it's doable to have a 30% renewable energy mandate in Michigan, and looking down the road a few years. I'm wondering, James, what are your thoughts as far as what it would take to get Michigan to that 30% level, and what would it mean for us?
I think what's critical here is to just keep a nice, steady, smooth transition going. It's not like you don't want to jump from 10 to 20 in a very short period of time, and that tends to kind of disrupt the grid and the technologies we're using. But we keep adding 1.5% a year and continue that, you know, for 10 years, then, you know, we're up to 25%, a little further up to 30%. So I think it's the idea of having a nice smooth transition to renewable energy, which provides us with, again, kind of some low-cost recently energy. And what's really important is that the very stable long-term contracts are providing more stability to our energy costs moving forward. Since wind doesn't rely on fuel, it's not as waiting for a fuel market to maybe spike and therefore cause unintended consequences. So we're not only kind of providing low-cost energy, but stable energy sources moving into the future. So, again, blending it in, and the report, I really commend the idea that we won't have any problem with our excellent reliability maintaining that as we blend up to that higher number.
And it is what needs to happen right now, policy-wise, to be able to have that 30% goal in place, John?
Well, Governor Snyder would like to make recommendations this year on what path to set for the future, and then it would be set legislatively. The legislature will probably spend a good portion of time in 2014 discussing and investigating the issues and then pass legislation that would apply beyond 2015. They could potentially do it during 2015. Conceivably, they could do it 2014 if they're ready. But the idea is to have a plan in place that would apply beyond 2015 again from the legislature.
Do you have any idea as far as a date when we might hear from the governor about his energy goals?
Well, there's been no date announced yet, but the governor is planning to do it before year end.
James, what barriers do you see in achieving that 30% goal by 2030?
One of the barriers I'm concerned about is it takes some lead time to start building these projects. So I'm hoping the legislature can move quickly. I think it'd be unfortunate if we wait until all the way to 2015, because that means that OPE utilities go back to the drawing board, they design new projects, new requests for proposals, and then maybe we're not building again until 2016, 2017. Mm-hmm. And I'm worried about that gap, because the nice thing about our RPS up to now is a lot of Michigan companies have been participating in this new renewable energy field. So we have hundreds of companies out there making parts, we're making towers, we're making blades, we're making the gearboxes. And I want to make sure that those people don't see a lull, we don't get layoffs, we don't see some of that economic development opportunity go elsewhere. So I'm hoping that we can kind of move quickly in kind of establishing our higher numbers. But then I think what we've seen in the request for proposals that the utilities have put out for their renewable energy up till now have been very well received, lots of proposals. So I think there's projects in the queue ready to go. I think we're now waiting for the policymakers to kind of set us on that course.
I'm getting a sense of, I think I am, from both of you, that the situation is pretty good, that it's looking promising, we've made this progress, and you both see a clear path to be able to increase our target. So is it your sense that the folks in Lansing who will make this policy are on board as well?
Well, it's kind of early to tell right now. I think we'll see how the governor's recommendations are received, and I think that may be the first indication of where we go from here.
John Quackenbush, chairman of the Michigan Public Service Commission, and he was joined by James Clift of the Michigan Environmental Council. Thank you so much to both of you for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Thanks. Cindy.
Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer is Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and John K. Wilson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening. Let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.